Chapter 3. You? Fire, fire, fire. It was in vain for me to hold the man and tell him he'd be galloped to death by the engines, pumped to death by his overexertions, wet-feeted to death by the slop and mess, flattened to death when the roofs fell in, his spirit was up, and he went scampering off after the young monkey with all the breath he had, and none to spare, and me and the girls huddled together at the parlor windows looking at the dreadful flames above the houses over the way, Mr. Buffles being round the corner. Presently what should we see, but some people running down the street straight to our door, and then the major directing operations in the busiest way, and then some more people, and then carried in a chair similar to Guy Fawkes Mr. Buffle in a blanket. My dear, the major, as Mr. Buffle brought up our steps, and whisked into the parlor and carted out on the sofa, and then he and all the rest of them without so much as a word burst away again full speed, leaving the impression of a vision except for Mr. Buffle awful in his blanket with his eyes a-rolling. In a twinkling they all burst back again with Mrs. Buffle in another blanket, which whisked in and carted out on the sofa. They all burst off again, and all burst back again with Miss Buffle in another blanket, which again whisked in and carted out. They all burst off again, and all burst back again with Mr. Buffle's articled young gentleman in another blanket, him holding round the necks of two men carrying him by the legs, similar to the picture of the disgraceful creature who has lost the fight, but where the chair I do not know, and his hair having the appearance of newly played upon. When all four of a row, the major rubs his hands, and whispers me with what little hoarseness he can get together, if our dear remarkable boy was only at home, what a delightful treat this would be for him. My dear, we made them some hot tea and toast, and some hot brandy and water with a little comfortable nutmeg in it, and at first they were scared, and low in their spirits, but being fully insured got sociable. And the first use Mr. Buffle made of his tongue was to call the major his preserver and his best of friends, and to say, my forever dearest sir, let me make you known to Mrs. Buffle, which also addressed him as her preserver and her best of friends, and was fully as cordial as the blanket would admit of. Also Miss Buffle. The articled young gentleman's head was a little light, and he sat a-moaning, Robina is reduced to cinders, Robina is reduced to cinders, which went more to the heart on account of his having got wrapped in his blanket, as if he was looking out of a violinsular case, until Mr. Buffle says, Robina, speak to him. Miss Buffle says, dear George. And but for the major's pouring down brandy and water on the instant, which caused a catching in his throat owing to the nutmeg, and a violent fit of coughing, it might have proved too much for his strength. When the articled young gentleman got the better of it, Mr. Buffle leaned up against Mrs. Buffle, being two bundles, a little while in confidence, and then says with tears in his eyes, which the major noticing wiped, we have not been an united family, let us after this danger become so, take her, George. The young gentleman could not put his arm out far to do it, but his spoken expressions were very beautiful, though of a wandering class. And I do not know that I ever had a much pleasanter meal than the breakfast we took together, after we had all dozed, when Miss Buffle made tea very sweetly in quite the Roman style as depicted formerly at Covent Garden Theatre, and when the whole family was most agreeable, as they have ever proved since that night, when the major stood at the foot of the fire escape, and claimed them as they came down the young gentleman head foremost, which accounts. And though I do not say that we should be less liable to think ill of one another, if strictly limited to blankets, still I do say that we might most of us come to a better understanding if we kept one another less at a distance. Why, there's Wozenham's lower down on the other side of the street. I had a feeling of much soreness several years respecting what I must still ever call Miss Wozenham's systematic underbidding, and the likeness of the house in Bradshaw having far too many windows, and a most umbrageous and outrageous oak which never yet was seen in Norfolk Street, nor yet a carriage and four at Wozenham's door, which it would have been far more to Bradshaw's credit to have drawn a cab. This frame of mind continued bitter down to the very afternoon in January last, when one of my girls, Sally Oregano, which I still suspect of Irish extraction, though family represented Cambridge, elsewhere absconded with a bricklayer of the Limerick persuasion, and be married in Patton's, not waiting till his black eye was decently got round with all the company 14 in number, and one horse fighting outside on the roof of the vehicle. I repeat, my dear, my ill-regulated state of mind towards Miss Wozenham continued down to the very afternoon of January last past, when Sally Oregano came banging, I can use no milder expression, into my room with a jump which may be Cambridge and may not, and said, "Her room is sis. Miss Wozenham sold up." My dear, when I had it thrown in my face and conscience, that the girl Sally had reason to think I could be glad of the ruin of a fellow creeter, I burst into tears and dropped back in my chair, and I says, "I am ashamed of myself." Well, I tried to settle to my tea, but I could not do it, what with thinking of Miss Wozenham and her distresses. It was a wretched night, and I went up to a front window and looked over at Wozenham's, and as well as I could make it out down the street in the fog, it was the dismalest of the dismal, and not a light to be seen. So at last I saved to myself, "This will not do," and I puts on my oldest bonnet and shawl, not wishing Miss Wozenham to be reminded of my best at such a time, and lo and behold you, I goes over to Wozenham's and knocks. "Miss Wozenham at home?" I says, turning my head, when I heard the door go. And then I saw it was Miss Wozenham herself who had opened it, and sadly worn she was, poor thing, and her eyes all swelled and swelled with crying. "Miss Wozenham," I says, "it is several years since there was a little unpleasantness betwixt us on the subject of my grandson's cap being down near Airy. I have overlooked it, and I hope you have done the same." "Yes, Mrs. Lirriper," she says in a surprise, "I have." "Then, my dear," I says, "I should be glad to come in and speak a word to you." Upon my calling her, my dear, Miss Wozenham breaks out a crying most pitiful, and a not unfeeling elderly person, that might have been better shaved in a nightcap with a hat over it, offering a polite apology for the mumps having worked themselves into his constitution, and also for sending home to his wife on the bellows which was in his hand as a writing desk, looks out of the back parlor, and says the lady wants a word of comfort, and goes in again. So I was able to say quite natural, "Wants a word of comfort, does she, sir? Then please the pig, she shall have it." And Miss Wozenham and me, we go into the front room with a wretched light that seemed to have been crying to, and was sputtering out, and I says, "Now, my dear, tell me all," and she wrings her hands, and says, "Oh, Mrs. Lirriper, that man is in possession here, and I have not a friend in the world who is able to help me with a shilling." It doesn't signify a bit what a talkative old body like me said to Miss Wozenham when she said that, and so I'll tell you instead, my dear, that I'd have given 30 shillings to have taken her over to tea, only I durst on account of the major. Not, you see, but what I knew I could draw the major out like thread, and wind him round my finger on most subjects, and perhaps even on that, if I was to set myself to it. But him and me had so often belied Miss Wozenham to one another, that I was shamefaced, and I knew she had offended his pride and never mine, and likewise I felt timid, that Oregano girl might make things awkward. So I says, "My dear, if you could give me a cup of tea, to clear my muddle of a head, I should better understand your affairs." And we had the tea and the affairs too, and after all it was but £40, and there. She's as industrious and straight a creature as ever lived, and has paid back half of it already, and where's the use of saying more, particularly when it ain't the point? For the point is that, when she was a-kissing my hands and holding them in hers and kissing them again, and blessing, I cheered up at last, and I says, "Why, what a waddling old goose I have been, my dear, to take you for something so very different." "Ah, but I too," says she, "how have I mistaken you? Come, for goodness's sake, tell me," I says, "what you thought of me?" "Oh," says she, "I thought you had no feeling for such a hard hand to mouth life as mine, and were rolling in affluence." I says, shaking my sides, and very glad to do it, for I had been a-choking quite long enough. Only look at my figure, my dear, and give me your opinion whether, if I was in affluence, I should be likely to roll in it. That did it. We got as merry as pricks, whatever they are, if you happen to know, my dear, I don't, and I went home to my blessed home as happy, and as thankful as could be. But before I make an end of it, think even of my having misunderstood the Major. Yes. For next forenoon the Major came into my little room with his brushed hat in his hand, and he begins, my dearest madam, and then put his face in his hat, as if he had just come into church. As I sat all in a maze, he came out of his hat and began again, my esteemed and beloved friend, and then went into his hat again. Major, I cries out frightened, does anything happen to our darling boy? No, 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 says the Major, but Miss Wozenham has been here this morning, to make her excuses to me, and by the Lord I can't get over what she told me. Hoity-toity, Major, I says, you don't know, yet, that I was afraid of you last night, and didn't think half as well of you as I ought. So come out of church, Major, and forgive me like a dear old friend, and I'll never do so any more. And I leave you to judge, my dear, whether I ever did or will. And how affecting to think of Miss Wozenham out of her small income and her losses doing so much for her poor old father, and keeping a brother that had had the misfortune to soften his brain against the hard mathematics as neat as a new pin in the three back represented to lodgers as a lumber room, and consuming a whole shoulder of mutton whenever provided. And now, my dear, I really am a-going to tell you about my legacy, if you're inclined to favor me with your attention, and I did fully intend to have come straight to it, only one thing does so bring up another. It was the month of June, and the day before Midsummer Day, when my girl Winifred Madgers, she was what is termed a Plymouth sister, and the Plymouth brother that made away with her was quite right, for a tidier young woman for a wife never came into a house, and afterwards called with the beautifulest Plymouth twins. It was the day before Midsummer Day when Winifred Madgers comes, and says to me, a gentleman from the consul's wishes particular to speak to Mrs. Lerper. If you will believe me, my dear, the consul's at the bank, where I have a little matter for Jemmy got into my head, and I says, good gracious, I hope he ain't had any dreadful fall. Says Winifred, he don't look as if he had, ma'am. And I says, show him in. The gentleman came in dark, and with his hair cropped, what I should consider too close, and he says, very polite, Madam Lerwiper. I says, yes, sir. Take a chair. I come, says he, from the French consuls. So I saw at once that it wasn't the Bank of England. We have received, says the gentleman, turning his R's very curious and skillful, from the Marriott sends, a communication which I will have the honor to read. Madam Lerwiper understands French? Oh dear no, sir, says one. Madam Lerwiper don't understand anything of the sort. It matters not, says the gentleman, I will translate. With that, my dear, the gentleman, after reading something about a department, and a Marie, which, Lord forgive me, I suppose till the Major came home was merry, and never was I more puzzled than to think how that young woman came to have so much to do with it, translated a lot with the most obliging pains, and it came to this. That in the town of Sons in France an unknown Englishman lay a-dying, that he was speechless and without motion, that in his lodging there was a gold watch, and a purse containing such and such money, and a trunk containing such and such clothes, but no passport and no papers, except that on his table was a pack of cards, and that he had written in pencil on the back of the Ace of Hearts, to the authorities, when I am dead, pray send what is left, as a last legacy, to Mrs. Lerper, 81 Norfolk Street, Strand, London. When the gentleman had explained all this, which seemed to be drawn up much more methodical than I should have given the French credit for, not at that time knowing the nation, he put the document into my hand. And much the wiser I was for, that you may be sure, except that it had the look of being made out upon grocery paper, and was stamped all over with eagles. Does Madame Lurwiper says the gentleman believe she recognizes her unfortunate compatriot? You may imagine the flurry it put me into, my dear, to he talked to about my compatriots. I says, excuse me. Would you have the kindness, sir, to make your language as simple as you can? This Englishman unhappy, at the point of death. This compatriot afflicted, says the gentleman. Thank you, sir, I says, I understand you now. No, sir, I have not the least idea who this can be. Has Madame Lurwiper no son, no nephew, no godson, no friend, no acquaintance of any kind in France? To my certain knowledge, says I, no relation or friend, and to the best of my belief, no acquaintance. Pardon me. You take locators? Says the gentleman. My dear, fully believing he was offering me something with his obliging foreign manners, snuff for anything I knew, I gave a little bend of my head, and I says, if you will credit it, no, I thank you. I have not contracted the habit. The gentleman looks perplexed and says, lodgers. Oh, says I, laughing. Bless the man. Why, yes, to be sure. May it not be a former lodger? Says the gentleman. Some lodger that you pardoned somewhere went? You have pardoned lodger somewhere went? Hem. It has happened, sir, says I, but I assure you I can call to mind no gentleman of that description, that this is at all likely to be. In short, my dear, we could make nothing of it, and the gentleman noted down what I said and went away. But he left me the paper, of which he had two with him, and when the major came in I says to the major as I put it in his hand, Major, here's old Moore's almanac with the hieroglyphic complete, for your opinion. It took the major a little longer to read than I should have thought, judging from the copious flow with which he seemed to be gifted when attacking the organ men, but at last he got through it, and stood a-gazing at me in amazement. Major, I says, you're paralyzed. Madam, says the major, Jemmy Jackman is doubled up. Now it did so happen that the major had been out to get a little information about railroads and steamboats, as our boy was coming home for his midsummer holidays next day and we were going to take him somewhere for a treat and a change. So while the major stood a-gazing, it came into my head to say to him, Major, I wish you'd go and look at some of your books and maps and see whereabouts this same town of Sens is in France. The major, he roused himself and he went into the parlors and he poked about a little, and he came back to me and he says, Sens, my dearest madam, is 70-odd miles south of Paris. With what I may truly call a desperate effort, Major, I says, we'll go there with our blessed boy. If ever the major was beside himself, it was at the thoughts of that journey. All day long he was like a wild man of the woods, after meeting with an advertisement in the papers telling him something to his advantage, and early next morning, hours before Jemmy could possibly come home, he was outside in the street ready to call out to him that we was all a-going to France. Young Rosicheeks, you may believe, was as wild as the major, and they did carry on to that degree, that I says, if you two children ain't more orderly, I'll pack you both off to bed. And then they fell to cleaning up the major's telescope to see France with, and went out, and bought a leather bag with a snap to hang round Jemmy, and him to carry the money like a little fortunatus with his purse. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.